Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
This is Way of the Dreamer, the show with Robert Moss. This is where we affirm and celebrate the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination. We have a wonderful writer with us today, a Danish writer who lives in Portland, Oregon. His name is Peter Fogdahl. We haven't seen enough of him in the English language, though he's well known in Denmark and has published a number of best-selling novels, 14 in total. He's only got a couple out in English, and one is just out. It's called The Mango Dancer. It's a romp. It takes you to the world of cults and gurus and India. You can smell India. It's very sensual, very tactile. Peter is a great traveler. He's a humorist. You'll find that out. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
Good to have you. Well, I follow you on Facebook, and I've had the pleasure of having you in a couple of my adventures in Romania, and I think in Mosswood Hollow near Seattle, and you are indeed a great traveler. So let's start by talking a little bit about your experiences of travels and how that feeds your writing.
Yeah, I mean, I am someone who writes better when I'm on the go. So traveling is incredibly important to me, and pretty much everybody who knew me thought I would die during the COVID when I couldn't travel. But I actually learned how to travel here and experience everything around me in a new way. But yeah, traveling is incredibly important to me, and I have a strong soul connection, especially with Italy. I mean, Umbria and Veneto, the area around Venice, to me are like soul homes, and I go there as often as I can, and it feeds my writing big time.
Yes, I've been following your travels to Italy with some envy, because I must admit I've never been to Venice. It's one of the places missing from my life on life itinerary.
Oh my God, you have to go.
I don't need to eat gelato the way that you do. I should note that Peter Fogdahl is also the author of a book of poetry called My Crimes of Gelato. You might pick up the fact that there might be a little bit of humor in that as well. I am delighted that you've been able to break out of the COVID situation sooner than some of us. I've been pretty much homebound for 2 years, having previously been traveling 7 months out of 12, and I haven't made the readjustment yet, but we'll see. And certainly Venice and the Adriatic will be on my list when we get to that point. So
yeah,
let's jump in with the new book, because I know that this is what you most want to talk about right now. The Mango Dancer, I know it's been through several incarnations. I know you've had to work patiently for a while to get it out in the English language. Tell us about the book. Tell us why we should read it.
Well, I have a lot of experiences with India. I used to follow an Indian guru. His name was Sai Baba. He was more known in southern India and in Europe than he is in the U.S. And to my mind, he started off like, you know, gurus and spiritual masters should. He seemed like the real deal. But then something happened, and that is often the case, as we know, with gurus, that they tend to fall. They tend to fall in love with all those things you're not supposed to fall in love with, you know, sex and money. And so I kind of followed, and I was in his ashram in southern India several times. And the more I was there, the more it dawned on me how fanatical people were. I mean, there wasn't really any difference between the devotees of this guru and in your regular sect, Christian sect or whatever, there wasn't any difference whatsoever. So I kind of experienced the nuances of gurus, and I think that is something that often that we often don't get. It's like we think that all these spiritual masters and gurus, either they are avatars and godlike human beings, or they are swindlers. There's nothing in between the two. And I wanted to write a funny novel, hopefully wise and funny novel, about that. And I started writing that in 2010, and I still remember 3 years later, I thought it would be out. So to my mind, also, that book has been the biggest personal development project I've ever been on, because it wanted to teach me patience, and I have none.
And well, you've made it there in the end, though. So you just to quote Peter, he just told us that gurus are either avatars or swindlers. That's a good line in itself. I think that ought to be on the back of the book. It isn't, but you've given it to us now. Of course, you know me. I'm not in favor of gurus of any kind. I want people to find the inner guru and operate that way, even if you're in the presence of an avatar. I don't want you to throw yourself flat on the ground. I want you to go inside. I was looking at the last page.
I totally agree with you now.
I was looking at the last pages of The Mango Dancer just before we came on, and what happens to Nick, your narrator and protagonist, who's a pretty cynical fellow in marketing, actually. Is he actually changed by the end of the book? Is this a book about transformation by someone who goes to try out gurus, is disillusioned, but is still maybe uncertain about whether there'll be a resurrection at the end? I'm not clear in my own mind about whether Nick has changed.
I actually like that you're not clear about that, because I don't want a black and white book. I do think he has changed, and I think the last three lines prove that, and of course I don't want to give away that, but I actually like the nuances of that. I don't want to write, you know, there's so many spiritual novels that spells everything out, and it drives me insane. Someone like Paulo Coelho, who's a good writer, but he always tells you what he wants you to think, and he always tells you spiritual truths, and I don't want to go that way. I want people, the whole book plays with doubt and with faith all the time. Faith and doubt, how you go back and forth between the two. I did not want a book where someone was just like totally following a guru and then finding out he was a swindler, because the truth is somewhere in between the two. And that's what I try to accomplish. So you could say that muddies, the work, but to me it becomes more of a literary work, because you keep on doubting how much he has learned.
Very interesting with fiction, you know, the relationship between autobiography and fiction. We both probably remember Flaubert being asked who is Madame Bovary, and Flaubert saying, well, c'est moi. I am Madame Bovary, in a sense of the novelist is drawing upon his or her own experience with whatever character they create. Reading Nick while knowing you, it was very hard not to see you in Nick in almost every scene. I mean, it's almost delightful, because you are delightful and you're a wonderful humorist, a wonderful conversationalist and raconteur, but sometimes almost embarrassing, because I thought you were right there. I was looking in on you in some of the scenes. Does Nick feel that autobiographical to you, or do you feel that he's actually
not at all, but I mean, a lot of people think that, not at all. I think he has the same sense of humor as I have, and that's what throws people off. And of course, also, like me, he's a Danish citizen who ends up in America, but I mean, he's been in America since he was 16. I've been here since I was 48. There are a lot of differences. I've been married twice. Emotionally, I'm not Nick at all. So it's the sense of humor, I think. When people know me a little, they totally think it's me. And a lot of people have said, you know, exactly what you are saying. But I do think to make a character work well, it's also important to take important parts of yourself. But no, he's not me, and everybody who really knows me well, like, you know, my ex-wife, my girlfriend now, would also say, oh, God, no, Peter is nothing like that.
The other work by you that I've read is, well, I read part of it, I enjoyed it, but I didn't actually get finished because I have a lot of reading assignments. But it's the previous novel that appeared in English, and it's called The Tsar's Dwarf, and we're not going into the world of Gimli and fantasy here. We're going into, actually, a very well-researched historical novel about a female dwarf from Denmark who was taken to Russia to join the Cabinet of Human Curiosities of Peter the Great, the Tsar. And it's very interesting that this book is in Ukrainian as well as English and I guess other languages. And you had quite an adventure with it in the Ukraine, didn't you?
Yeah, but it's funny because it was a bestseller in Ukraine. And when I was interviewed on national radio, the host said something I thought was so interesting. She told me why it was such a big success. She said, everybody sees the dwarf as Ukraine, and Peter the Great as the oppressor. And she said, that's why I think it's been such a success in Ukraine. And needless to say, I'd written the book, 10 years earlier, and that had never, ever struck my mind. I had never thought of that way. So, yeah, but as you said, it's a historical novel. It's for people who have a dark sense of humor, they will actually find it funny. And other people just find it tragic. To me, it's a tragic comedy about human dignity. A dwarf that is trying to survive a total brutal world because we know, like, in the early 1700s, dwarfs were not considered human beings at all. I mean, if people met a dwarf in the street, it was totally normal that they would pick up the dwarf and perhaps throw her into a wall to see if this was, you know, really alive. So it's a very tragic, but also quite humorous book, especially if you have a dark sense of humor.
Yes, it's very, very strange. It's a very curious book, very curious story, very well executed, and very strange to read it in the midst of the tragedy in Ukraine at the moment. But nonetheless, they have some bearing on each other. Actually, I noticed in the last pages of your new book, The Mango Dancer, you have a character who announces that he is half Ukrainian. I don't know. So Ukraine pops up a couple of times in both of your English novels in the English language. Peter, let's talk a little bit. I'm sorry. Go on.
No. I was just gonna say that I fell in love with Ukraine because I've been there three times. You know, and I was.
Yes, you have love affairs with countries, don't you? It seems to go very deep with you.
Italy is number one.
Seem to have soul landscapes. I mean, countries that speak to your soul, speak to your connection beyond place and time. I think we all do. As a writer, someone who's very good with words, you evoke this passionately and well. So this leads me to the next question, which is something that interests everybody, especially those of us who write or would like to write. I mean, it's about writing practice. I mean, I can see that your travels feed your writing in many ways. I mean, writing is redolent in a very sensory way of streets you have walked, things you have eaten, things you have smelt. But tell us a little bit about, over the years, what your writing practice is like. Have you had a daily habit or a weekly habit? How do you approach getting things on paper?
I mean, I don't really have any rules. I'm not someone who sits down and decides I have to write today. I don't work like that, but I tend to write well in the morning. I'm a morning person. I'm up very early. But I don't really, I can't say that I have one habit that I actually find quite irritating. I always start with the beginning. I think that's kind of sick. You know, I would like to be a little more, sometimes I would like to be a little less in control. Because, you know, I do believe that the writer isn't just writing himself. And so what happens to me is often that the last one-third of the novel, that is when I feel that I'm out of control in that beautiful way when spirit or muse or whatever you want to call it is inspiring you. But sometimes I actually would like to change that form a little. And I think one of the reasons why I also wrote a poetry collection is it's such a different way of writing. It's even more intuitive. And I think that's about it, what I can say about the process itself. But obviously, I love the fact when I forget myself, you know.
Do you like to, I mean, I know you like gelato, I think you like coffee and tea and things like that. I mean, do you do writing in coffee shops, for example?
Yeah.
Do you like to be in a certain environment other than at home, or do you prefer mostly to write at home?
No, both. I do love coffee shops. You're absolutely right. I write a lot in coffee shops. The only place I cannot write is when someone is around me. I cannot do that. Like, if I have emotional conflicts with someone, I simply cannot write. But if you're in a coffee shop, you're neutral, you know. I mean, you don't know the people around you, so that doesn't disturb me. So my only rule is, if, like, I have conflicts with people, and I'm a very emotional person, you know, very sensitive, and I pick up stuff I don't want to pick up, you know, then I cannot write at all.
Mm. Do you keep a journal?
I do, and that's you know, and that's often also when I get messages, you know, messages from other worlds, you know, from ancestors, information about earlier lives. And I used to think it was imagination, and it's actually only within the last few years, and also by taking your brilliant workshops in Romania and Mossroot Hollow, I mean, that I've actually started to have more faith in my own, whatever you want to call it, psychic ability or whatever we want to call it. You have helped me a lot with that.
Do you share things as you're writing a book? Do you read things or show parts of the book to someone else?
Yeah, I do. I'm not someone who just, but people I really trust, you know, people who like my writing, but also people who tell me this isn't good enough. And actually, both my girlfriend I have now and my two ex-wives, I would show them things here and there, because they were really good at it too. They had that combination you want. They were critical, but they really liked your writing, you know.
And what about how your reading affects your writing or does not affect your writing when you're a reader as well as a writer? Do you find yourself going on, you know, reading binges of a certain kind, whether it's research or whether it's writers who have something to teach you, or whether it's writers who are unsatisfactory, but whose example might inspire you to think, well, I can do this better. So what's the interaction between your reading and your writing?
No, I am someone who reads while I write. I know a lot of writers who say, I don't want to be influenced, I'm not going to read anyone. I'm not at all like that. Since this is that kind of radio program, I think I can admit that I've had an almost personal relationship to Hermann Hesse, the German writer, and Karen Dixon. They're big inspirations, but I've also had dreams with them. And I can tell that to you because you won't think I'm insane. But while I was writing The Mango Dancer, and I almost start to cry when I tell you this, I had a dream where Hermann Hesse was driving my car. And the second I woke up, I knew that he was helping me with The Mango Dancer. And of course, I'm not a Nobel Prize, you know, winning author, but I do have the same worldview as Hermann Hesse, and I think it's because of that that there is the connection. We're both mystics. I mean, the way he lived his life is also an inspiration to me, so I've definitely felt that Hermann Hesse somehow helped me writing The Mango Dancer, which in a certain way is, you know, not as good, of course, as Siddhartha, but does tell the same kind of story of someone who grows into spirituality, doesn't have faith, then he has faith, you know, back and forth and back. So, yeah.
So you you dreamed that Hermann Hesse was driving your car. I mean, not a bad set of hands on the wheel for somebody who's going to drive his way through a book. I rather like that. You're reminding me that one of my dreams of an author with Scandinavian associations, not a Scandinavian author, I dreamed that I met C.S. Lewis and Tolkien together, and they gave me some advice and were encouraging me, and the scene was like the New York Public Library. And Tolkien says to me with great urgency, you must study Scandinavian mythology. He doesn't say Norse, he said specifically Scandinavian mythology. And then some years later, when I was writing a book, Lewis, whose friends called him Jack Lewis, turned up again. And I said, where's Tolkien? And Lewis says, oh, Tolkien's not talking to you at the moment because you didn't do what he said. You have not been studying Scandinavian mythology. So then I did study Scandinavian mythology, and funnily enough, right now, I'm reading or rereading a lot of Tolkien and Lewis as well, because they came to the conclusion that dreaming is absolutely central to discovering the things they thought were important, like the real story of Atlantis, like the real story of human purpose. They decided that dreaming was the key to time travel and traveling to other dimensions. So I'm thinking about that at the moment. We're talking to Peter Fogdahl, F-O-G-T-D-A-L. You can find The Mango Dancer, his delightful, and sometimes challenging book about gurus and India and life. You can find it only at Amazon. Sorry, if you don't like Amazon, sorry, that's where you get it. He very bravely decided to go and publish it himself after a long time waiting. So The Mango Dancer, which I recommend. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Mouse, and I think we're about to take a break, and we'll be back shortly.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Gingivitis, gum disease, words you don't want in your mouth. But according to the American Dental Association, 3 out of every 4 adults will develop gum disease. Now there's an all-natural way to fight back. Introducing the Natural Dentist Herbal Gum Therapies. Developed by a dentist and clinically tested by a leading university, the Natural Dentist Herbal Gum Therapies daily oral rinse and toothpaste was proven to kill the germs that cause gum disease better than the leading brands. Regular use was proven to reduce gingivitis and bleeding gums. The Natural Dentist contains herbs like echinacea and aloe vera and has no alcohol or sugar or harsh chemicals. The Natural Dentist is guaranteed to work or your money back. You can find The Natural Dentist at most drug and health stores, including Trader Joe's, Save-On, Walgreens, and Long's Drug Stores, as well as most health stores, including Whole Foods Markets and Wild Oats. Call 800-615-6895 or visit www.thenaturaldentist.com for more info.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back. This is Where the Dream with Robert Moss. Do hop over to mossdreams.com. You'll see I'm leading quite a few online courses, including my training for teachers of active dreaming. And if you're interested in that, there are preconditions that you have time to fulfill them before we start level one again. There are other programs coming up. And we have as our guest today Peter Fogtal. His new book is The Mango Dancer. He's the best-selling novelist in his native Denmark. We haven't seen enough of him in the English language, but as you can hear, he's well worth hearing from. He's a humorist. He's a traveler. He's a spiritual guru in his own mind, I once saw him say of himself. The Mango Dancer is a book that instructs us and provokes us on the theme of gurus, who we trust, who we don't, who we're dealing with, avatar or swindler, and all that good stuff. And Peter's also a dreamer. He's a dreamer to the extent that he's come to a couple of my depth workshops and shared some dreams, and we've discussed those dreams together. And one of them, Peter, as I recall, you met a being, an Egyptian deity, that after discussion we decided might be Wepwawet, who looks like Anubis, but is not exactly the same. Wepwawet is the opener of the doors who tends to walk in front of the royal army and make sure that the paths of victory are open. I seem to remember, anyway, discussing the identity of this Egyptian deity with you in the context of one of your dreams.
Yes, yes. It was very memorable for me because I have fought my destiny a tiny bit, and that's what the dream showed. I have, even though I'm obviously extremely interested in spirituality, and I also used to be an astrologer, I still am a bit, but I just don't take clients. So I've always been interested in the spiritual world. But in terms of worldly ambition, I've always been about my novels. I mean, my novels have driven me, and sometimes too much. And then I had a dream. I had a dream, and that's the one you helped me with at the workshop. I had a dream where there were two, I was shown two pathways. And one of them was obviously the pathway as a novelist, you know, your typical novelist, bestsellers and all that, just a writer's writer. And that one did not end well. That led into a door where everything was dark. And then the pathway of the spiritual being, what my soul really wants, is to combine the two, and that I use my writing to help people instead of just, you know, being this egoic bestseller writer whose mind was also always ambition. And Wepwawet, and you were the one who identified him, I had no idea who he was. He was blocking the door of ambition. And the other door was light, and full of light. Also, when I went into the dream, that was full of light, that I just had to follow that pathway instead of just going, instead of just being this ambitious writer's writer.
Very interesting, these dreams of guidance. Thank you for sharing that again. Found it fascinating working on that dream. Thinking about my own life, Peter, I've been guided in terms of publishing decisions and in terms of directions to take as a writer and as someone looking for publication again and again and again. I mean, there are many, many, many turning points. I probably have got into most trouble when I haven't heeded the guidance from the dreams clearly enough. I'm going to tell you a funny one. It's not one of the biggest ones, but a funny one. I made a decision to leave the path of a commercial best-selling thriller writer, which I was doing very well back in the 1980s, but I decided to leave that path and basically follow the path I'm now on as a dream teacher who still writes books but doesn't sell millions of copies anymore. And one of the transitional dreams, helping me make my adjustment from what I thought life should be like beforehand to what it was going to be now, I'm at an airport and I'm going through customs in a very familiar scene, very symbolic in certain kinds of dreams. And I'm being held up. I'm not being treated badly. It's just taking me a while and things are not moving fast. And there's this gorgeous, voluptuous woman in furs with Louis Vuitton luggage. And she's being treated like a goddess, and she's being ushered through ahead of everybody else. She turns to me, she blows me a kiss, and she says, "Bye for now, darling. Maybe we'll meet again." And I understood at that moment. I'd said goodbye to my happy hooker. I'd said goodbye. I said goodbye to the successful, over-the-top aspect of myself who was willing to do just about anything required to go out and sell lots of copies of books. I mean, in those days, I could go on any... You know the same thing in Denmark. I could go on any TV show, any radio show I liked, and the pretty little production assistants would fall over me because I'm on the New York Times bestseller list. When I left that behind, the dreams helped to adjust me to the situation I had chosen, and one of the ways to help me adjust was to give me Gloria. I decided that was her name, the over-the-top happy hooker. Goodbye, darling. Perhaps we'll meet again.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. But I do think that's also what we have in common, that we both have, you know, we both have a background as novelists, and then we are kind of shown that it's not just about that, and
I must say, Peter, I have not had the pleasure of reading your books that are not in English yet, although if you ever get me a copy, I'll read the one that is in French, which is particularly interesting, but I don't read Danish despite my efforts to do what Tolkien told me to do. I think you have a calling as a novelist beyond the one that I have. I was very successful as a novelist, but I don't know that it's a fundamental calling because I haven't done it for a long time. However, in my dreams, and, you know, I'm very interested in parallel lives and the way that they sometimes are reflected in dreams in which we find ourselves in, you know, parallel situations. In my dreams, I notice that on at least two interesting tracks, I am very much a novelist. On one of them, I'm writing fiction for young adults and children as well as adults of a magical, fantastical kind, a path I nearly started to follow more than a decade ago, but didn't really stay with. And on the other one, I am not exactly the commercial thriller writer that I was, but I'm writing very superior historical espionage novels, redolent of Central Europe in the middle of the 20th century, which is a path I could have followed. And it seems to me, looking at my dreams, that I am following those two paths of novelist, and I don't know that I feel the need to do it in my present life. It's sort of somehow satisfying me for me to, rather than just frustrating, think, oh, I'm doing that. You know, I'm doing that over there. It's all right at this stage if I don't try to import all of it into my present timeline. So sometimes I find when I think about the lives we might have led and the regrets we sometimes have, I sometimes find that for me, my dream life removes the regrets because it's showing me what things might be like. It's neither better nor worse necessarily, just different. And the knowledge that I might be doing that somewhere else is, in a way, comforting and satisfying in the track I'm currently on.
Yeah, no, I remember you told me that. And by the way, thanks for telling me that my calling is as a novelist as well, and still is, because I actually just within the last 2 weeks, I thought I was going to write a nonfiction memoir book about my past life experiences. And within the last 2 weeks, I found out that I actually have to write it as a novel. And I have just walked around telling everybody I wasn't going to write novels anymore. So you have
all right. This is good, Peter. Hold the thought. We'll come back to this in a moment. We have to take a break. This is Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our guest is Peter Fogtell. His new book is The Mango Damper.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcasting coders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com. webcasting.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
This is Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our wonderful guest today is Peter Fogtal, best-selling Danish author who lives in that wonderfully weird city of Portland, Oregon. We were starting to talk about a sense of calling in life, the calling of the novelist, the calling of the writer. Before I ask Peter to talk more about his own sense of calling and what he might say to those of us who are seeking a vocation in life, I might reflect for a moment on my favorite American philosopher. He's a very homespun American philosopher. Most of you know him, Emerson. Some of you have read his essays. He wrote an essay called Spiritual Laws, in which he said, this is the key line, there is one direction in which space is open to us. There is one direction which space is open to us. What the heck does that mean? Well, in its context, and I'm paraphrasing, he says that your calling is your power. And to the extent that you can find your calling, your life calling, and pursue it without wandering away from it too far, you'll find that the wind is at your back and the current is flowing your way and it leads you to where you need to go. But if you depart from your calling, then you'll run into all sorts of obstacles, sandbanks, reefs, all sorts of problems, yeah. The wind is against you and so on. And I, when I found this paragraph in his essay, I thought, oh, that really is true for me. That's what it's about. It's about finding and then following your calling with a passion. And the exertion, but also sometimes the relaxation. It's not necessarily about working all the time. It might be about relaxing into it. But stay in that general direction. And the problem for many of us is that we haven't found the calling. But I think Peter, from what I've seen of him, has a calling. He has a calling to amuse us and educate us a bit at the same time. And he definitely, I would say, has a calling as a novelist. So Peter, talk to us a bit more about your sense of calling and the fact that you feel that you might be going back to write another novel in the near future.
No, I agree with everything you say, and I would actually like to explain this astrologically, because to my mind it's very simple. Wherever your sun is, in which sign, and especially in what house, will actually show your calling, because the great secret about astrology is that it's not necessarily that good at explaining your personality, and the sun sign definitely isn't, but it will describe your calling. And since I'm Gemini and I have my sun in the eighth house, that shows that one of the things I need to do is to dwell into the human psyche and communicate about it, telling stories about it. And I find after, you know, I've done at least 1,000 horoscopes when I used to do that. I don't anymore for clients. And I agree with you. The calling is, of course, the most important because it's very simple. You will be happy if you follow your calling. And if you don't, you are not going to have that great of a life. So if you follow what your parents say, what society says, you're going to be pretty miserable. You have to go within and follow that inner voice. And, I mean, that's what I have done. My mistake is that I, for years, did it only for me, that this was my personal ambition. And now I know that I need to lift people with my writing. I need to spiritually lift people. And as you said, it's often with humor, and it's often also being very serious. And I have both sides, and I think I'm fairly decent at switching back and forth, also when I do my public talks, with being, you know, very serious and also very childish. So yeah, the calling is what makes you happy. The sun in your horoscope shows what makes you happy. It's that simple.
You are a man also, by my observation, who's very drawn by ancestral considerations. You've done all these DNA tests, and you've tracked that, and you've written about different countries and different people and different times you feel are related to, sometimes literally, sometimes otherwise. I am deeply convinced that we are connected to stories in other places and times. For me, the bloodlines, the genetic inheritance, is less important or less interesting, though of course it's important, than the connections to the spirits of the land where you live and travel, and the connections to your spiritual lineages, I say plural, which are not necessarily identical with your bloodlines, but all three kinds of ancestral connection through the bloodlines, through the land, and through the spiritual lineages are, I think, extraordinarily important. I think the ancestors are calling, and it might be part of our calling, our personal calling, to hear their voices. So talk to us a little bit about how you've been drawn to follow the stories of people connected to you in other times and places.
Yeah, I mean, the ancestral part is very, very new to me. I've always been someone who had experiences with past lives and my soul's journey. But what is new is that the ancestral part has come into my life. I've taken a course, Ancestral Medicine, with Daniel Four. That's been very good, and that has opened up for ancestral connections I didn't know I had. So right now I'm actually discovering that one of the reasons why I am so fond of Italy is not just the three or four incarnations I know about, but I'm actually 6% Italian in my DNA, which I had no idea. And I've been in contact, my first contact with an ancestor is a nun around 1800 in Piacenza, in Emilia-Romagna, in Italy. And I actually went there. And the interesting thing about it is that I got an intuitive hit about that before I took the course. And I simply looked at an Italian map, and I've been to Italy at least 30 or 40 times. I've lived there a tiny bit as well. And I looked at the map, and I said, you know, I want to go to Italy, but now I have to go to a different place than I usually do. You know, I'm extremely fond of Assisi and Venice especially. And then I just looked at Piacenza, and I just said, that's a wonderful name. And then it turned out out that 2 months later I got my DNA test back, and my family way back, eight generations back, is from the area around Piacenza. And I just came back from Piacenza and felt a connection to a nun, and that is what I'm writing about now. And I would probably call it a novel, but it's also a bit of a download, because I have a decent connection with her now. And I'm someone, because I have, you know, a fairly decent imagination, I don't always trust myself, but I've really learned what I'm sure most people know already, that the goosebumps, when my body reacts to information, that's when I know it's a fact. So the first time I got in touch, you know, through meditation or whatever you want to call it, with that nun from Piacenza in Italy, when I asked what I could do for the lineage and for her, and when she simply told me that when you get to the Duomo in Piacenza, please light a candle for me and the priest that she fell in love with, which of course was a scandal back then. And when she said that, I broke down and cried. So I just came back from Piacenza and I lit those two candles, and it felt great.
Very, very interesting, Peter. We'll come back to that after the break. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Hey, The Mango Dancer, that's the name of Peter's new novel in English. Go to Amazon and check it out. I'm afraid that's the only place you can find it, but go to Amazon and check it out, and I think you'll enjoy it. And you're enjoying him, I know. So we'll be back in a moment to talk a little more about how we hear the voices that call us to certain ancestral connections and certain creative projects. We'll be back after the break.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. EarthChannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to EarthChannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call EarthChannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978. Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back. This is Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. We're going to continue our fascinating conversation with Peter Fogdahl, best-selling Danish author, resident in Portland, Oregon, a world traveler, author of many books, including the newly published Mango Dancer. You need to find that on Amazon. That's where it is. We are talking about how the spirits of the land, the ancestors of the land, who may or may not be ancestors of your bloodlines, might find you. Peter, very briefly, in return for your wonderful story about the nun in Italy, I must recall that when I moved to upstate New York to the edge of traditional Mohawk country, I started dreaming of early residents of this part of the world. We're talking now about the early 1700s, one of whom was an Anglo-Irishman. He came out here, became King Superintendent of Indians. He knew the Mohawk very well. And because I found myself dreaming into his life, I went to Ireland and visited the places of his birth and early early formation, I found myself drawn also into the dreaming of the Native Americans he knew best, and this got so deep I had to learn their languages and study the whole thing and fill my library with books, all the papers, the Indian papers and so on, and write three novels, historical novels, to separate myself from his story. We are distantly related, Norman Irish, distantly related. So that's what happened to me by traveling to a certain part of the world. But let's come back to Hermann Hesse for a moment, and I'll explain why. In the Glass Bead Game, I've forgotten what his German title is, but that's the English title, one of the exercises I recall of the acolytes, of the apprentices, is that they are to write autobiographies, or a few pages of autobiographies, of people they might be connected to across place and time, writing in the first person, narrating in the first person, as someone living in another time. Now, that's something that you practice, I think, as a writer, as a novelist. Doesn't your The Tsar's Dwarf speak in the first person?
Yeah, it definitely
Are you going to do more
does.
Of that? Are you going to write, for example, the nun in Italy, the 17th century nun? Have you written something in her voice? Might you?
Yeah, and that will be in first person. And I can tell you something that you might find a little interesting is that I can write first-person novels in English as well as I can in Danish. But I would never, ever be able to write a novel in English in third person. I can't explain why, but I need the voice, and I probably need a voice that's fairly close to my own. But the nun, yeah, that would be a first person, and it would be partly, I don't want to call it channeling. I think that's a little too much. But, you know, it will be, half fiction and half real, you know.
Writing in the first person, as we both know, does solve all sorts of problems of perspective. I've published 9 novels. I've only written one of the novels in the first person. It's the voice of an 18th century character. And he loves the theater. He's a very theatrical character. He comes to the American colonies and runs into stuff he'd rather not have to deal with. He's a humorist. I must say I enjoyed writing in the first person profoundly, but it also required me to write in the voice of the 18th century. So it's a novel that received wonderful reviews but didn't get that many readers, because there were not that many readers at that moment anyway who wanted to read the 18th century English style. I must say I found it a delight to speak through his voice. And he's not autobiographical in the sense the circumstances of our life are completely different. But, of course, we must have some affinity. We have affinity to many people, don't we? We're connected to all life. You know, no human life is alien to a human, actually. So we can adopt different perspectives.
I
look forward to reading your new writing and hearing some new voices.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to ask me what I prefer, I do think I prefer first person. And The Tsar's Dwarf, the novel we talked about Ukraine and Russia, as you said, is also in first person. I love getting into a character. She's a woman, and I'm obviously not. But I think one of the things I was proud about concerning The Tsar's Dwarf, I never met a single reviewer or single person who said I wasn't believable writing from a woman's point of view, and I like that, I must admit, you know.
You're reminding me of some advice I was given by a very literate French woman who came to many of my workshops in France, and noted that although I love the French language and learnt it when young and even wrote one of my dissertations on French literature and history, I'm still not confident in conversational French. And she said, Robert, you have to get over this. What you need to do is to write a novel in French, in the first person, in the voice of a woman. Maybe something like Colette, she said. And the lightness of that suggestion really attracted me. And I actually wrote 2 or 3 pages in the voice of a Colette-like narrator in French, and I had no difficulty whatsoever, but I didn't continue.
Wow!
It was an interesting suggestion. So, you still with us? Can we drop the call?
For the first time you dropped out, I couldn't hear you. That's the first time it happened. Are you there?
Yeah,
I said, well, we're still here. That's good. I just thought that story might have somehow sort of dropped the line. Sometimes we get gremlins or imps that like to play around, depending on what the content of the conversation.
Yeah.
So, Peter, any last things you'd like to tell us about, you know, your inspiration, your work, the Mango Dancer?
I'm very fond of India as well. You talked a lot about, you know, about location as well and soul experiences. The funny thing about India is that even though I think I know about 8 of my incarnations, I don't know anything about India. But India, the second I arrived in India, I felt very much at home. But I don't have a specific place in India, but there's something about the culture and the food, by the way, that I just really, really appeals to me. And to my mind, the Mango Dance is also a celebration of India, because I do think India is the most fascinating country in the world. It's also the most infuriating country in the world.
Yeah.
When you travel there 8 times, you would know, and most people tend to agree with both, that it's very infuriating to be there, and it's unforgettable. And that love for India, I think, is also, hopefully, in the Mango Dancer.
Well, that's another reason reading Peter's book, The Mango Dancer, will take you on a trip to India. You don't have to buy a plane ticket. You don't have to worry about COVID restrictions. You can just go. It is. Peter does have a great gift as a sensory writer. He does engage your senses. You can smell, taste, and touch his scenes, and it's even there in the title of the book. So I'll be back in a moment basically to say thank you and dream on. We've been talking to Peter Fogdell. His book is The Mango Dancer. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Back after the break.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. EarthChannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to EarthChannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978. Well, we've been talking to Peter Fogdell about life, humor, India, Italy, contact with deceased nuns, his novel, The Mango Dancer, which I recommend. Thank you so much for sharing so much of yourself with us, Peter.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me. I just love it. Love it, love it, love it.
Well, you've given us, you know, a little tour of many places. We've been traveling without leaving home. And as I say, Mango Dancer, go and look at it, Amazon.com, and go to my website, mossgreens.com. You'll find lots of news there. All right, from now and forever after, may your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.